Hello, my name is Racheli Lovglass. Welcome to Torat Imecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. Today we will be studying Sefer Nehemiah, Perek Zion, the 7th chapter. Yesterday we learned about the 5 attempts of the Tzara Yehuda to block the wall's completion and how Nehemiah managed to shut them down and complete the construction project while exhibiting consistent faith in Hashem and building up the people at the same time. Today we're going to see that it's not enough to just feel safe building a wall, but we also need guards. The other topic, the Perek's transition today, we can actually title the other Ezra Perek 2, as this Perek copies it almost entirely. Okay, let's begin. Pasuk Aleph, Vayhi kasher nivnita hachoma v'amid hadlatot v'yipakdu hashorim v'hamishorim v'halevim. And it was when we finished building the wall and I established the doors, I appointed gatekeepers and singers and levim. So the gatekeepers of the Beit HaMikdash were not of the wall. They were commissioned together with the singers to deliver a message that Nehemiah is about to have. Pasuk Bed v'atzavet Hanani achi, and I commanded Hanani my fellow v'et Hanania sar habira, and Hanania the head of the capital al Yerushalayim, kihu kiish emet v'yarei et Elokim me'rabim, because he is a man of truth and he fears God me'rabim. We'll talk about that word means of the majority or from more. Okay, so let's first discuss this word me'rabim. What does that mean? So Rabbag actually says more than others, that Hanania fears God more than other people at the time feared God. And Malbim said that most people feared the masses despite instructions. And Nehemiah wanted someone here who would fear God more than the human allies, which is an important piece. I also think it's important to notice that Yerushalayim here is called Ir Habira, our capital city. Just to be, you know, politically correct, notice that Jerusalem is a capital, you know, way back already. Okay, Pasuk Gemel, Va'omar Lahem, and I said to them, Lo yipatru sharei Yerushalayim ad chom ha-shemesh. The gates of the city of Jerusalem cannot be opened until midday. Va'ad heim omdim yagifu hadlotot, and until the people are there, they must remain closed. Ve'echozu ve'amid mishmarot yoshrei Yerushalayim, ish b'mishmaro ve'ish neged beito. So Nehemiah points these men, Hanania and Hanania over Jerusalem, issuing very strict orders regarding the hours during which the city gates are allowed to remain open. And he decrees that the city walls are closed for the early part of the day, only to be open when the guards are there, and they have to set up shifts from residents of the city to guard with local advantage all other times of day. But while the guards are there, the doors need to remain shut. So Rabbi Zakkai tells us that Nehemiah was really faced with a dilemma. He could not rely on the loyalty of the Kohanim, and he uses instead the Levim, because many of the Kohanim had ties by marriage to the opponents. Yet he was not able to displace them completely because his religious commitment forced Nehemiah to support the activities of the Kohen in general. So this solution of his actually was really clever. He does not diminish the Kohanim's duties. He just dilutes their power, kind of like lifting the Levium up from the underclass and giving them a real stake in the work of the Mikdash. And besides, the Levium also deserve this because they volunteered right away to build the wall, aligning themselves with Nehemiah. So in particular, in addition to restoring the Levium's traditional role as singers in Mikdash services and guardians of the temple entrances, he now organizes them to be this new, so to speak, ad hoc security force. Okay, so these gates remained closed until noon, and at noon, when it was the hottest time of day, it made sense to then open them because that was the least likely time to attack a city when it was too hot, very oppressing the heat. So Nehemiah does this really to avoid enemy attack. The rest of the day, the doors are closed and guarded. The neighborhood watches were to be established, and everyone had to keep an eye near the wall of his own home. Okay, Pasuk Dalet and Hey, V'ha'ir rachavat yadayim u'gdola, and the city is very wide, V'ha'am me'at, and the population in the city is very small, betocha, within the city. V'ein batim b'nuyim, and there are not finished houses. V'yiten elokai elibi, and Nehemiah says that Hashem placed an idea in my mind. It's interesting for us to see how Nehemiah always gives Hashem credit for his good ideas. And what is this good idea? I gather the noblemen and the lay people, and all the people to kind of show their yichus, their genealogy, and I found the book of recordings of genealogy, Ha'olim Barishona, of the original Olim, Va'emtza Katuvbo, and I found such and such written in it, and the rest of the parak talks about what was written in it. Okay, so even at this point, the city remains uninhabited and people don't have homes in which to live. And given the confusion over who might have rights to which homes, Nehemiah discovers and relies upon a document summarizing the very, very first wave Olim from way back in Sefer Ezra, the second parak, and in which these Olim go to their ancestral homes, which we first encountered way back in Ezra. So Nehemiah had actually asked the head of each of the families to show him their lineage or their documentation so that he could assign who would populate Jerusalem, our undefeated capital. So Nehemiah, what he's going to do is establish the size of community. And once he figures out who's there based on the original census, he will say basically that 10% of people counted must now live in Jerusalem. So Malbim says that since they did not have built up houses, they don't want to live in sparsely settled cities. So what Nehemiah is going to do, he's going to cast lots to get people to live there. And he needs to know which families are there via the original census. Dot Mikra, a little bit different, says that Nehemiah wondered how to fix the problem of the lack of population within Yerushalayim. So he needed to establish a new national census to check the letters of lineage so that the new leaders will show up to be counted. So really, according to Dot Mikra, this census sounds like a gimmick, trying to get leaders or people who want to be leaders to show up and kind of have their names on a plaque. But what Nehemiah is actually going through are lineage of families to determine whom to place where. And one advantage of starting with the original list from Perek 2 of Ezra is that it really is integral for Nehemiah because it links his activities to a national history anchored in the very, very earliest Aliyah. For the Second Temple period, and giving people with a sense of historical legitimacy and national cohesion by linking his activities to the past, they really demonstrate that Nehemiah's activities are part of and really culminate in an entire process of return from the Galut of Babel, from this exile. I saw something fascinating. Rabbi Avigdor Nevensal asks a very interesting question, which really we could ask later on in chapter 11, where it tells us that the nation blessed all the people who volunteered, so to speak, to settle in Yerushalayim, even though they weren't really volunteered, they were somehow more than strongly encouraged. But what does that mean, according to Rav Nevensal, that the rest of the nation blessed these people? So the notion of blessing those living in Jerusalem, that it should all go well, points really to a Gemara in Ksubos about the process of an aliyah being really difficult. And yet the value of living in Israel and the debates really poses this question for Rav Nevensal. What can one spouse, he asks, demand of his or her spouse? Can a woman can demand a standard she's used to? What if the man wants to move to an urban area and she doesn't, or vice versa? So all this stems from this idea of living in Yerushalayim. Can one spouse push the other to make aliyah, or can one spouse push the other to move to Yerushalayim? So the Gemara says people don't really like living in cities, which is apparent by the fact that here we see people have to bless those who are living in cities because it must be a difficult process. Rav Nevensal says that when Israel was really sparse, that was something that was very understood, but it's not really difficult to live in Jerusalem now when it's crowded. And Rav Nevensal quotes Baba Kama that there were 10 items about Jerusalem that made it exceptionally arduous. Some of them being that you were not allowed to plant orchards or certain gardens, and you could not raise chickens there. Very strange. So why not? Because of the smell of the fertilizer and the chickens that peck in the dirt, which can carry with them maybe a smell to the produce that we use for truma, and it could contaminate sanctified items. So Rav Nevensal said that that means that residents didn't really have fresh vegetables or eggs. So for sure they didn't have any shakshuka, but halachically this is not really the case anymore as part of the bylaws of Jerusalem. But interestingly, it is still true of the old city of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah is really dealing here with a threat where he's afraid of the protagonist and their crew, and he has a diminished, vulnerable Jerusalem that people don't want to live in because of some of the prohibitions surrounding it. And Nehemiah claims that Hashem told him to make this census, and to do that, he has to go back to the old list he finds from the arrival of Zerubbabel back in Ezra Perek 2. So we're not today going to go through the whole list, but there are a couple things that I do want to notice. And one big thing to notice is that Nehemiah did not do, which is to say, I found the old list and let's move on. Like, he could just tell us, I am using the list from Perek Bet. He doesn't say that. Instead, he concludes the fifth Pasuk, and then he gives, from Psukim 6 to 68, he quotes the old list almost entirely, but not completely verbatim. There are some changes. I do want to mention a couple of things. If we look at Pasuk Vav, it says, Ela b'nei ha'medina ha'olim mishvi ha'golah. These are the people who are returning and making aliyah from the exile of Bavel. Asher Hegla Nebuchadnezzar. These are the descendants of the original exiled people from those who Nebuchadnezzar displaced. And Vayashuv Lusham Velihuda Ishliro. And everybody goes back to their original hometowns. Pasuk Zayin tells us Habai, who comes with Zerubbabel, and it lists Yeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ramia, Nachmani, Mordechai, Bilshan, Misper, Bigvai, Nechum, Bana, Mispar, and Sheyam Israel. So tightly structured, this census really begins by emphasizing each of the families detailed in the chapter, restoring them to original hometown. Then, as we just saw now in Pasuk 7, some of the most prominent returnees are mentioned by name, such as Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Mordechai, Bilshan, and others. So a question to ask is, who is this Mordechai? And the Talmud actually asserts that this is the reference to the Mordechai of the Esther story, but the Talmud also asserts that his full name was Mordechai Bilshan, which alludes to the fact that he was fluent in 70 different languages. Bilshan has the root word in it of Lashon, of languages, and that he's a member of the great Sanhedrin. The position, though, of the Gemara is adopted by Rashi, Ralbag, and Ezra, but they also accept that Mordechai is the same of that of Esther. Some of them maintain that Bilshan was a different person. The suggestion that Mordechai really makes Aliyah presumably after the Purim story is really intriguing, but it seems very difficult for a lot of people. And it seems unlikely that he would have considered leaving the Jewish community of Persia after having been elevated to this real position of prominence in Persia's government. So grappling with this problem, Ralbag actually hypothesizes that the matter had been so desperate in Judea that Mordechai actually felt compelled to travel and assist in completing the Beit HaMikdash. Masechet Megillah, though, does note something. It notices that Mordechai's name on the list here in Pasuk Zayin is further down the list than it was in Ezra Perek Bet. And he says that Mordechai, the Masechet Megillah tells us that Mordechai's name goes down in stature and on the list because he took on the political role. Okay, so afterwards, the chapter then lists the returning families in the following order. It gives a whole bunch of psukim for the regular lay people of Israel, and then it lists the Kohanim, the Levim, including the singers and the gatekeepers. And then it mentions, in quite a few psukim, it mentions the Netinim, who since the days of the Geonim of the story of Yehoshua, they were the Jewish people's servants. And then it mentions Avdei Shlomo, those servants that were captured who worked for the Jews, and they converted on purpose just to be servants of the Jews, almost like the Erev Rav, who really just wanted to stick around with the Jewish people. Now, some families were unable to properly establish their genealogies in this mass census, and they couldn't establish themselves either as Jews or even as priests. So the governor at the time, known as Hatirshata, which is potentially Nehemiah, determined that they were no longer eligible to partake of any of the korbanot, of the sacrifices, until a priest bearing the Urim V'tumim breastplate could come back and resolve the doubt that the people have. So after listing the servants and the livestock of the Olim, which ironically were only non-kosher animals, it mentions over 7,000 animals altogether, including camels, horses, donkeys, and mules. None of them are kosher, which means that these are not going to be used for korbanot, but they're really just used to help the Olim carry their wares. It's not even for them to travel on, because 7,000 animals is nowhere near enough for 42,000 and change people. So it's important for us to notice that the Jews that do make Aliyah, they're traveling on foot. So talk about the idea of Mesiris Nefesh, of sacrificing so much for your ideals, for your religious Zionism, so to speak. These are Jews who made Aliyah because they believed in what they were doing, despite the difficulty of the challenge of making Aliyah. And it's important to note, I think, that one of the most unusual aspects of the census is that it really is reproduced in whole, with some minor variations, as I mentioned before, between Ezra Perek 2 and Nehemiah Perek 7. So Malbim is really the lone commentary who believes that these are two different lists, not an updated list, not a newly changed list, but that they're two totally different lists, and that we have to recognize that. Malbim says that earlier in Ezra Perek 2, there was a comment on the original list, and he points us to a very subtle variation in the very beginning of each of those prakim. In Nehemiah here, it's in verse 6, and in Ezra, it's in the very first verse of Perek 2. And he says that the Olim, the returnees of Ezra, came from Bavel. The Nehemiah text says that they were returnees from Nebuchadnezzar, but it doesn't say the ones that Nebuchadnezzar brought to Bavel. And the second difference is that in Ezra, it says they returned to Judea and Yehuda, but in Nehemiah, it says they returned to Judea and to Yehuda. So any normal mortal, like myself, and probably most of the listeners, you don't even notice such a difference. But Malbim and his methodology, his methodology is really a throwback to Midrash style, where every single letter and word is meaningful. And he notices everything, and he has an explanation for everything. So why the word difference of tu and Bavel? What was Bavel? So he says we need to understand history. We're not necessarily referring to the Babylonian Empire, which gets its name from the capital city, Babylon. But exiled to Babylon is the original list. The second list does not mention the capital city because the elite were exiled there, the Cheresh of Masker and the young children. Everyone else was scattered throughout the Babylonian Empire. And the list in Ezra is a smaller group, only the elite who went to the capital. But the list in Nehemiah is more inclusive. The second point about two Judea versus Judea is that Malbim is a grammarian, and when you have the word two, it means they went to both places. If it doesn't say the word two, they just went to various cities within Judea. The first list is a people of stature, and Nehemiah's list kind of adds the people of the later exile and also returned eventually. The extra names and the larger number, according to Malbim, really includes the people who joined the first group. And when construction of the Mikdash was halted, many people of the first wave of Aliyah, of returning to Israel, returned to Persia out of fear. So the numbers are really very different. Okay, barring all those minor variances, the question that we really have to have is, why is the repetition, or the censorious in general, if it's not the repetition, something that Nehemiah feels it's so important to do? He's not talking to his contemporaries, he's talking to us, you know, thousands of years after him. And the truth is, as the contemporaries of Nehemiah configure the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, he recognizes what's being saved for posterity, really for us. So the Da'at Mikra tells us that logically you would say it's repeated here because Nehemiah needed it pragmatically to assign everyone of the one, out of ten, their space. And Nehemiah, or the author, really has great love and respect for those initial Olim. When things are repeated, we're trying to emphasize a point. It could be repeated to say, we love the brave founders who left Persia and established themselves, and they really deserve an encore. The chapter kind of ends with mentioning that a number of the leaders are joining together to contribute gold, silver, and priestly garments towards the rebuilding. And the chapter really concludes by returning to where it started, stressing that the family settled together in their original homes. V'chol Yisrael v'areihem. And to me, that is the most magical phrase, because it tells us that despite all the challenges they went through, whether it's the exile, whether it's the halting of construction of the temple, or halting of construction of the wall, or the abandonment they felt from God, or the taunting that they felt from the Tzara Yehuda, these Jews are religiously, Zionistically inspired to be connected to their legacy, to their ancestral homeland. And that is something really marvelous that really links all the generations. And having completed the resettlement of the population, tomorrow we're going to learn in Perek Chet, in the 8th Perek, how Nehemiah really turns to matters of spirituality. Thank you for studying together. Le'iloi Nishmas, Malka Esther, Batzvi Yosef.